I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, who is the president of Brazil? Jair Bolsonaro. I mean, yes, we know that Bolsonaro is essentially looked upon as being the Brazilian equivalent, if you will, of Donald Trump. But how did he get into power? Who were the forces that backed him and are benefiting from his presidency? All these questions and much more are answered by returning guest Brian Meir of Brazil Wire and Telesur English. Brian has a new documentary out entitled Dismantling Brazil: Bolsonaro's Neoliberal Agenda, which can be viewed free of charge on YouTube. He joins us to talk about that documentary and explain the damage that Bolsonaro has done to the beautiful country of Brazil and how he got into his position of power. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Brian Meir. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Brian Meir of the Brazil Wire and the great new documentary Dismantling Brazil, Bolsonaro's Neoliberal Agenda. How are you doing, Brian?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, this documentary just came out. It's a short documentary. For my listeners that, you know, should be paying more attention, I think most of them do, to politics around the world and not just in the U.S., who is Bolsonaro?
Okay, well, Jair Bolsonaro is currently one of the international boogeymen. You know, he's singled out as being one of the worst leaders. Glenn Greenwald called him the worst politician in the world a few years ago. And he's been singled out as the worst respondent to the COVID crisis. He's the first president in modern history who's been openly anti-vaccine, for example. But what he really is he's the figurehead of a project to basically just dismantle the Brazilian economy, dismantle industry, and there's big economic interests behind him. So he's a kind of like flashy right-wing demagogue, you know, who uses Steve Bannon-type techniques to install hatred in his followers. And, you know, Bannon helped in his campaign. But he's really just like the best possible person that international capitalism could find to defeat the left, you know, and consolidate this project that started with the 2016 coup of dismantling the 1988 Constitution, taking apart all of the social and labor rights, and privatizing all of the, you know, natural resources in the country to foreign multinationals.
Could you tell my listeners a little bit about the 2016 coup, and I think really important here, the U.S. sort of involvement? I mean, we had media outlets like the New York Times who they're acting critical of Bolsonaro because he's destroying the rainforest, his reaction to COVID. And yet these same media outlets basically seem to have backed the coup.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So basically, after the left won four consecutive presidential elections, it became clear that this kind of like neoliberal project backed by the U.S. Democratic and Republican parties was never viable electorally. So at this point, the U.S. began spying on the president's office, 29 of her top advisors, and the Petrobras State Petroleum Company, which had just discovered the world's largest offshore oil deposits. And this was revealed by Snowden in 2014. You know, Biden at this time was vice president. He met with President Dilma Rousseff and refused to stop spying at this point. And the U.S. worked together, the U.S. Department of Justice and FBI worked together with a small group of public prosecutors in Curitiba, which is a city. It's the most conservative big city in Brazil. It's home to the largest Nazi rally that ever took place outside of Western Europe in the 1930s. And so they worked on this anti-corruption case together called Car Wash or Lava Jato, and Forum shopped it to this one judge, his district in Curitiba, where no crimes involved had taken place. And they used this investigation as a way of continually leaking slander and character assassination into the media to prepare the public for this impeachment against Dilma Rousseff. And in 2015, the year before the coup, this one judge from a local court district in Curitiba, he ordered full paralyzation of the five largest construction and engineering companies in Brazil. This caused an immediate 500,000 direct job layoffs and over a million indirect. And he also paralyzed the shipbuilding industry and other key sectors of the economy in the name of this investigation. In other words, the opposite of what the U.S. did with Goldman Sachs during 2008, what Germany did with Volkswagen in treating companies too big to fail. Because of accusations against a few businessmen in these companies, they threw everyone out of work, put the economy into a nosedive. There's a study that was cited in the BBC that shows that this action alone by Lava Jato caused a 2.4% drop in GDP in 2015. So this caused Dilma Rousseff's popularity to nosedive. And at this time, the U.S. hegemonic media stepped in to validate the project, to normalize the project. And so it started running really negative articles about Dilma Rousseff, implying that she was tied up in some kind of corruption with Petrobras Petroleum Company. No charges were ever filed against her for anything like this. She was never even accused of personal enrichment from any kind of corruption scandal. In fact, she was impeached for an infraction that was a non-impeachable offense in Brazil called fiscal peddling that she was later exonerated from totally, but also that was legalized by the Senate one day after she was thrown out of office. But during the week before the 2014 presidential elections, for example, before the coup project started, the New York Times ran eight articles associating her with Petrobras corruption. So there's this multi-year project in the northern media to just damage the reputation of the PT. Even John Oliver, you know, was making jokes on his show about Petrobras and State Petroleum Company and corruption and Dilma Rousseff and things like that, without knowing what he was talking about. I mean, Jimmy Dore did an entire episode praising these crooks in the Lava Jato operation, you know, who we now know because there's been all of these leaked audio messages, leaked Telegram conversations, right? That shows that the judge was giving instructions to the prosecution the entire time during the lead up to Lula's imprisonment, during his imprisonment, and that they were meeting with a group of 18 FBI officers every 2 weeks for like 5 years. But at this point, Jimmy Dore did an entire show about, he said he wanted to buy a Sergio Moro t-shirt.
And Sergio Moro, for my listeners, that was the judge who put Lula da Silva away. And oddly enough, I think for a while, he ended up in the cabinet of Bolsonaro and then had a falling out eventually.
Yeah, well, okay. He, not only did he arrest Lula, and the Supreme Court opened an exception to the Constitution to allow them to jail Lula during election year when he was the leading candidate, when he had more than double the support of Bolsonaro. All right. Not only did he do that, but he also illegally leaked slanderous information against Lula's replacement candidate, Fernando Haddad, the week before the election, which is another crime. And immediately afterwards, he was made justice minister by Bolsonaro. Then there's now evidence that he met with Bolsonaro's team before he released this information against Haddad. Okay. And let's keep in mind, he was a judge. He was supposed to be impartial. In 2016, Time magazine made him a personality of the year before they even arrested Lula. Like, just the idea that he might arrest Lula or order Lula's arrest, Time magazine made him personality of the year. Notre Dame Law School invited him to speak at their graduation ceremony. You know, I mean, he was treated like a celebrity in Financial Times, Guardian, New York Times, and everything. But like, he's a judge. So why are you treating him like a celebrity before he's even ruled on anything? Isn't he supposed to be impartial? But now we know, of course, he wasn't, because he was giving instructions the entire time to the prosecutors on how to make sure that, you know, Lula got arrested. And they admit in these conversations that they had no evidence against Lula. You know, it's really insane to see this week Financial Times complaining that the Lava Jato operation was just ended in Curitiba, you know, as if it was a positive thing. It really ruined Brazil to the point where I think it even backfired for the Democratic Party, because they didn't want someone like Bolsonaro empowered out here, I don't think. You know?
Why was it so important to take down Dilma Rousseff and Lula da Silva? What were they bringing to Brazil?
Okay, I mean, it's a complex issue, and there's several reasons. And some of the things Lula cites, I interviewed Lula with Michael Brooks last year, and I interviewed him for this documentary too. But one of the key factors is oil. You know, now if you look around, the offshore oil discoveries made by Petrobras State Petroleum Company would place Brazil in the top five oil producers in the world. You know, now if you look around at the top five oil producers in the world, you know, or the top 10, how many of those has the U.S. started wars with or waged coups in? I mean, the first CIA-sponsored coup in history was against Iran for refusing to privatize its state petroleum company. Now, Dilma Rousseff had allocated, she'd issued a executive order allocating all of the profits from Petrobras to the public health and education systems, you know? And this is just something that, obviously, the U.S. wanted access to the petroleum, but there's other issues as well. You know, the BRICS was flexing its muscles. The BRICS was talking about abandoning the dollar in international transactions. This annoyed the United States. Lula said when Obama heard this rumor, he immediately called him up and said, what's going on here? You know, are you guys seriously thinking of abandoning the dollar? And there was this issue with Boeing where Dilma Rousseff chose to purchase fighter jets from Sweden instead of from Boeing, you know, which pissed off people in the defense industry. Then the Swedish deal allowed technology transfer, unlike Boeing deal. You know, Boeing was like a black box. There's some crap, shitty equipment, you know, that wouldn't work in an actual battle against the U.S., obviously. And, you know, Brazil was like developing its nuclear program. Lava Jato, few people know this, but the Lava Jato car wash investigation just arbitrarily arrested Brazil's top nuclear scientist. And the guy spent several years in jail for like with no material evidence. And so, you know, there's a couple of and then there's just the issue of sovereignty. You know, whenever a country in Latin America starts exercising any kind of sovereignty and acting independently, the U.S. normally will try to have a coup d'etat there.
I want to comment on that real quick, because I think there's a long history of this, and I would recommend people read the work of a former CIA agent who became a whistleblower, Phil Agee. He's talked about the coups in Brazil, Guatemala, Uruguay. I mean, this has been going on and repeating over and over again. The U.S. Seems to support these basically military dictatorships against the left in South America.
It's not even always just the left. It's just any president who tries to exercise any kind of sovereignty. There's even like center right. There was this Lava Jato investigation was expanded all over South America and Latin America. They used Odebrecht construction company and the corruption investigation against it as a kind of Trojan horse to go after leaders in Ecuador, you know, in Peru, in Panama, El Salvador, all over Latin America, Chile, Argentina. And, you know, some of them weren't even really leftists. They were just for like one of them in Peru was against a free trade agreement with the Americas, even though he was center right. Just, you know, any kind of sovereignty. Remembering that Odebrecht Construction was one of the big international competitors with Halliburton and Bechtel, who you read about in Confessions of an Academic Hitman, you know. So this was a company that was really beginning to really compete with these companies that are very tied to the U.S. integral state. And it was completely destroyed by this investigation, you know. But in terms of, you know, like overthrowing, I love that book, CIA Diaries by Philip Agee. And there's another one specifically about Brazil called U.S. Penetration of Brazil by Jan Black, which was written in the 1970s about the 1964 military dictatorship. And we know that really it all just goes back to the Monroe Doctrine. You know, the U.S. thinks it has this God-given right to interfere in any country in Latin America. Latin America is the U.S.'s backyard. And so in any, you know, there was a study that was published in Harvard Latin American Review about 10 years ago, and it studied the period between 1894 and 1994. And it documented 44 U.S.-sponsored coups during that period in Latin America, an average of one every 2.4 years. And that doesn't count the ones that didn't succeed, which are always going on. And we know that since 1994, obviously, the rhythm has not slowed down. I mean, most recently, we had the U.S.-sponsored coup in Bolivia, which thankfully was overthrown, in which the Bolsonaro administration helped the Trump administration. And we see during the Obama administration, we had Paraguay, Honduras, and Brazil, you know, all at least partially supported by the U.S., if not completely orchestrated by them.
Real quick, too, you cut out for a second when you mentioned a book, Confessions. I think you meant you were talking about Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry about the audio issues.
I just wanted to make sure because I think listeners should really read that book.
Okay. Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Exactly. So you see how that book is really good for showing how the U.S. Integral state operates. The integral state meaning, I don't like using terms like deep state or something like that because it's twisted around by a lot of people. But integral state would just be like the government and the institutions that support the government, like corporations, academia, the media, and how they all work together. And Confessions of an Economic Hitman talks about how the U.S. government, you know, works with the construction industry in other countries abroad, you know, to pressure third world countries to spend huge amounts of borrowed money on projects that they know won't work just so that it benefits U.S. corporations.
Now, what's interesting for me is I feel like this documentary Dismantling Brazil, I almost feel like it could be called the controlled demolition of Brazil, because I think that's what Bolsonaro is. I mean, he's a wrecking ball. And it's really interesting. I have a U.S. embassy link up that says fact sheet, the United States and Brazil. And get this, it says partners for a prosperous hemisphere, U.S.-Brazil economic ties, advance prosperity for both nations. And then it says our partnership advances democracy in the region. And I feel like facepalming because it seems like none of that is true.
No. When they say advance democracy in the region, they meant that finally, after 20 years, the U.S. government convinced Brazil to help them try to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela. That's what they're talking about when they say advanced democracy.
Well, and how has it really benefited economics in Brazil? How has it benefited people?
Not. I mean, maybe the elites, some of the elites have made money off of it, but hunger is going through the roof right now, as we show in the film, and me and Michael Fox, you know, and As Brazil increased food exports by 40%, hunger is going through the roof. Millions of people have fallen back below the poverty line. So the average Brazilian is, and labor rights were completely destroyed after the 2016 coup. One of the first things that happened was a constitutional amendment transforming Brazil into a right-to-work nation. So the unions were just gutted. You know, they don't have any, a lot of unions are now opening, have opened restaurants in their headquarters to try and make money because their funding's been butchered. And this, you know, that's a direct hit on the PT party, which is the only legitimate left party in Brazil that has a working class base of labor unions and working class social movements. So they did it specifically to damage the PT because, as I said before, they were unbeatable electorally. So, you know, the project now, one of the things before the shit heart started hitting the fan with Sergio Moro and the audio leak, the telegram leaks and all this stuff, he was announcing that Lava Jato was going to start going after labor unions for corruption, too. So it wasn't enough to destroy labor laws. He was planning on trying to arrest labor leaders as well, which is, you know, a textbook example of fascism.
And you were saying also, and I didn't mean to cut you off, basically what you're saying, when they're saying, when the U.S. Embassy, this website, is saying, oh, we're advancing democracy, no, it's advancing U.S. interests, ultimately, is what is at stake. That's what they really are talking about.
They mean their democracy. They're advancing their democracy, which we know isn't very democratic, you know, from the Electoral College, things like that. But when the U.S. says advancing democracy, they just mean advancing U.S. interests. I mean, look at how we brought democracy to Iraq. That place is just so democratic right now, I'm sure, you know?
Well, you know, one of the things, while watching this documentary, I have to credit you because covering this kind of thing, I would just, part of me finds it depressing. It was a hard-to-watch documentary in some ways, and there's chilling moments in it, particularly when Bolsonaro, you have that footage at one of his rallies where he says, and I quote, "We are going to gun down the Workers' Party supporters here. We're going to run these bums out of the state acre." This is, you know, full force fascism.
Yeah, he's a textbook example of a neo-fascist or a sub-fascist, according to the criteria developed by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky in their book about Latin American fascism. You know, it was originally based on the military dictatorships that the U.S. propped up in Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay, you know, some of which you read about in Philip Agee. And, you know, it's, you always get these hacks in the media trying to both sides everything to normalize, you know, governments that will hand everything over to international capital. So there was a bunch of clowns trying to argue that Bolsonaro is not really fascist. And I even see this on the chat board for the documentary and stuff like that. But the fact is, you know, a lot of people don't understand the difference between Latin American neo-fascism and Hitler or something like that. But the fact is, like, Bolsonaro is literally someone who was an official, a military official during the dictatorship. His vice president is a general from that dictatorship, and he's appointed over 6,000 military officers to his government. There's currently more military in the Brazilian government than there were during the last 8 years of the military dictatorship. 17 of his ministers are military generals. His health minister is a military general who served during the dictatorship, who is not a doctor and has no public health experience. You know, so it's really absurd to imply that it's not fascist. You know, the main difference between like sub-fascism and Hitler-style fascism or Mussolini is the nationalist element. The sub-fascist subordinates his country and its interests to the United States in Latin America. So it's like, you know, go ahead. Sorry.
No. Finish, please.
No. So in the relationship that Bolsonaro had with Donald Trump is, you know, best explained by through this framework of sub-fascism.
I was going to add to that. I think Bolsonaro has actually even spoke pretty publicly with these admiring statements about the U.S. supported Brazilian military dictatorships, which basically ruled the country from what, 64 to I think 85?
Yeah, no, he's like when he dedicated his impeachment vote to the military colonel during the dictatorship who was in charge of torture, who tortured Dilma Rousseff. Like he dedicated, his sons walk around with t-shirts from Pinochet and from this guy, Colonel Brilhante Ustra. So that he said the only problem with the dictatorship is that it didn't kill enough people. It should have killed more people instead of just torturing them.
It's interesting how that language, he keeps using it. As I mentioned, that quote from the rally, we're going to gun down the Workers' Party supporters. And people will say, oh, well, that's just hyperbole and whatnot. But using this language is playing with fire. I mean, it's very deliberate. This is about scaring people into submission while he privatizes everything.
It's worth mentioning that that state where he gave that speech, Acre, was the state that Chico Mendes was from. It's the state in Brazil with the biggest green forest economy in the Amazon jungle, which when he took the presidency, still had 98% of its virgin forest canopy intact. And it's one of the main places where they're ripping and burning down forests right now. And it had been run, it's where Marina Silva came out of, and it had been run by the PT party since the 1980s. It was the one state in the Amazon region that was controlled by the PT. And it was by far the best one in terms of environmental protection. You know, and that's just openly, it's under control of his people now, and they're just ripping everything down there.
What has happened to the people of Brazil? And I know you cover this in the documentary. What has happened, especially to the poorer communities under the reign of Bolsonaro?
Well, you have to look at it from 2016 forwards, because there was a 180-degree turn in political economy and things like that. The poor and working class are still better off than they were before Lula was first elected president. I mean, there's still a lot of gains that were made. I mean, he quadrupled the minimum salary. In real terms, even it was raised even more. When he took office, the minimum wage was like $50 a month US. And when PT left office, it was like $315 a month US. Still not, you know, first world standards, but a lot better. And now it's dropped down to about $200 a month. Still better than it was when he took office. And they opened up a quota system for the public. He built 17 new public universities free and opened up a quota system where 50% of all slots for the universities goes to working class people who went to public grammar schools and high school, with a small differential for Afro-Brazilians. And this is like, as of last year, for the first time ever, they've managed to achieve this quota. So some of the things they set up are still working and moving forwards. But in general, everyone's slipping behind. You know, I see more and more families living on the street, more children's, you know, when I go out and walk around in São Paulo, I see like mothers with babies sleeping in cardboard boxes and stuff like that. The homeless population is really increasing. Poverty is increasing. 240,000 people have died from COVID, which is very bad, but not as bad as the US, you know, still. because at least there's still, even though they've gutted the public health system, at least we still have a public health system with universal access. But you see now he's like openly discouraged people from using masks. And lied about chloroquine curing COVID, saying, don't worry about it. You can just take chloroquine if you get sick. You don't have to worry about social distancing. And he's refusing to send oxygen to Manaus, where all these people are dying right now. So, and it's, you know, the people who are dying the most from COVID are the poor, because they're not providing enough incentive for people to socially distance. And poor people can't really anyway, because they're cramped into these small rooms and houses and apartments in favelas and things like that. So you see that the direct effects are that people are dying, hunger is going up, child labor is coming back. Those are some of the big factors, things that are happening with the poor right now.
In terms of if the Brazilian people and the poor and working people of Brazil are not benefiting from Bolsonaro, who are the beneficiaries of this man's reign? I even hesitate to call him man. He reminds me of a vampire. He's a monster to me, but...
Yeah, well, it's the, you know, the rich are benefiting. There's a big transfer of money, like in the neoliberal period, like in the U.S. Massive amounts of transfer of money from the... Brazil's one of the richest countries in the world, even though it's a developing nation. It's upper middle income country. It's like, it was up to number 6 in the world under the PT. Now it's like 9th. Even so, that's a lot of money. And a lot of money is being transferred from the hands of the poor and working class into the elites. Just like during the Trump administration, when he gave $250 billion in tax cuts to the rich, it's really just a money transfer out of the hands of the middle class to the rich. And so there's what Franz Fanon would call like a bourgeoisie class or comprador elites who are connected to international capital. Big businessmen in Brazil who are making a lot of money. You know, there's a bank called BTG Pactual. It's a kind of hedge fund and financial investment bank, for example, that it was founded by Bolsonaro's finance minister, Paulo Guedes, who's one of the original Chicago boys from the 1970s, who studied under Milton Friedman and lived in Chile during the Pinochet dictatorship. He founded this bank, BTG Pactual. And they're huge now, even though most of their investors are from abroad. We didn't go into that in the documentary. But like the owners of Fiat are a big investor in it. And also, I am hesitant to even mention this because of the conspiracy theorists, but the Rothschild family owns a big stake in it as well. They just purchased the National Bank's credit card operations for 12% of their real value. You know, so the privatizations that are underway are going often to Brazilian elites at pennies on the dollar. So they're making a fortune. The banks are making a fortune in Brazil off of this too. You know?
I was going to say, doesn't specifically BlackRock tie into this as well?
BlackRock's making a lot of money, yeah. BlackRock has moved in and other big foreign investment banks and hedge funds. BlackRock has taken over the largest national gas station chain that was privatized, you know, with a couple other investors. And it's making a lot of money off Amazon deforestation. Cargill is making a lot of money. I mean, the fact that agricultural exports increased by 40% last year, the companies that make money off of that, they're mostly foreign companies. It's international agribusiness. Monsanto, Cargill. Cargill, for example, once Bolsonaro was elected, he immediately started giving out signals, dog whistles and code words to local loggers and people who work on the international value chain for agricultural commodities, that they would not be punished for cutting down trees in indigenous reservations and national parks. And at that moment, Cargill announced it was building a $200 million grain silo terminal on the edge of what's called the Ring of Fires in southern Amazonas state on the Madeira River, knowing that all of the soy they were going to be shipping out was coming from national park and indigenous reservations. You know?
Wow. It's horrible to see what Bolsonaro, with backing from international capital, has really done to this beautiful country of Brazil. The thing that gets me is how Bolsonaro, as I understand it, goes around saying that he's an outsider. He's just sort of like your everyday man. And at the same time, people like President Lula da Silva are treated as the corrupt insiders, when really, to me, that's all gaslighting. I mean, da Silva, when I see him in the documentary, he seems like, you know, the everyday man. And Bolsonaro just seems like this flashy, not man of the people type figure. It's very bizarre how he's created this narrative that he is the everyday man, the outsider.
Well, this is Bannon, you know, Steve Bannon. He did the same thing for Trump. Now, Bannon was working with the Bolsonaro people to help craft this fake image. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous, really, you know, like, and people fall for it. And one of the things that Bolsonaro does is that he and his people use this language of common sense the same way that the Trump people do. And so he expresses things in common sense terms so that people who are not very political just go, oh, well, that makes perfect sense to me. An example would be like this affirmative action program that was put in by Dilma Rousseff, you know, which gives 50% of the university slots to the working class. It's not even specific. It's a class-based affirmative action with a small differential for Afro-Brazilians. But since most Afro-Brazilians, 80% of the working class is Afro-Brazilian anyway in Brazil, then there's no need to be specifically race-based on the affirmative action. But the way that Bolsonaro's people frame it is like, we're not racist like those communists. We think black people are just as smart as white people. That's why we don't need quotas. You know, and it's like to someone who's not very political, that's like, oh, okay.
It's interesting. I like that you mentioned the use of this like common sense tactic, because Ronald Reagan used to do that a lot too.
Exactly.
And he would always say, well, it's just common sense. And when, you know, you have a politician saying it's just common sense, it's hard to argue with them, because you basically have to say, no, you're just full of it. These figures on the right use this rhetoric in a way where they just try to shut down debates right off the bat.
It's true. I mean, it's just like this argument that you should run a country like your family finances that they always use. You know, you have to balance your books. No, a family can't print money. So it's a shitty analogy. A family doesn't own a mint, you know, and a family can't borrow $1 trillion from Saudi Arabia. So it's a stupid analogy to say that you have to balance your books.
What's interesting to me, too, is it feels to me that it wasn't Lula that was involved in corruption. It feels as if Bolsonaro is the corrupt one, that the Bolsonaro regime is just one of absolute cronyism.
Completely. Not to say that there was no Brazil, like the United States, which I believe is the most corrupt country in the world. Brazil's also a capitalist country with huge economic interests from the world's most corrupt industries, you know, like mining, petroleum, construction, pharmaceutical. These are all really corrupt industries. The private sector is incredibly corrupt, and Brazil's operating within this international capitalist system that's amazingly corrupt. And there's definitely low and mid-level corruption during the entire time that Lula was president. However, they did more to fight corruption than any other presidency in Brazil, you know, that I've ever heard of. And I've lived here 25 years. For example, during Fernando Henrique Cardoso's presidency, he was the golden boy of the Clintons and everything. He underfunded the federal police so much that a scandal came out where the U.S. ATF was paying individual federal police agents through deposits in their own bank accounts to work on investigations for them. And the CIA was operating out of a federal police headquarters and buying vehicles for the police officers. And so they were so underfunded that they didn't even have autonomy to act. They were just accepting money from a foreign power illegally in order to keep an operation. So Lula like increased the budget and increased autonomy for the federal police, who turned on him, you know, because it's essentially an elite right-wing institution. He used technical criteria instead of political alliance for selection of Supreme Court justices, which also turned out to be kind of like a mistake for being, in my mind, like too honest, because some of those justices also like turned on him and supported this totally fraudulent Lava Jato investigation. And, you know, they did all kinds of things to fight corruption. In fact, one of the big errors of Dilma Rousseff was that she allowed some people to convince her to legalize coerced plea bargain testimonies in corruption investigations. And this just opened this huge can of worms where, you know, they're arresting people, threatening them with 100-year sentences unless they read off of a script. And then they get partial asset retention and, you know, house arrest for a year and they're free. And so this is how they got Lula, with one coerced plea bargain testimony from a corrupt businessman who changed his story three times before they let him out of jail. You know, but it was done out of an attempt to clamp down on corruption. You know?
Before we close out, what has the cronyism, has there been cronyism, like specific examples that we can point towards under Bolsonaro?
Yeah, of course. He tried to make his son ambassador to the U.S. I mean, he's been busted trying to directly intervene to get the federal police to stop investigating his children in the murder of Marielle Franco, who we're pretty sure they're involved in this murder, right? The city councilwoman who was killed in Rio de Janeiro. Like, he was caught on tape, you know, talking about swapping out the federal police director to someone who would stop investigating his kids. So there's all kinds of examples of cronyism.
It's like a bottomless pit. You go down the rabbit hole and you can just find example after example.
Just get the finance minister selling the National Bank's credit card operations through the company he founded.
So if there's one thing that you want viewers of the documentary, let's say they listen to this interview and they watch Dismantling Brazil, which is on YouTube free of charge, what do you want people to get out of Dismantling Brazil?
Well, I guess the key thing I'd like people to get out of it is that if you consider yourself to be a leftist, it's not enough just to be like chirping at people on Twitter. Solidarity is one of the key principles of socialism. And I think that right now there's a window of opportunity in the United States to pressure the Democratic Party, despite all their involvement in building the situation we're at right now, to pressure the Democratic Party to isolate Bolsonaro. You know, and there was just a 31-page policy paper submitted to Biden 2 days ago by this coalition of academics and activists in the United States with 6 recommendations on how they could punish Bolsonaro to improve the human rights situation down here. So I would just recommend that people call their congressmen and tell them that you would like to support that paper and the recommendations in that paper, and that you would like to support, you'd like to pressure the government to isolate Bolsonaro and to stop genocide against indigenous peoples and cutting down the rainforest and all of the other crappy things they're doing down here.
The last thing I want to mention, just real briefly here, you and I were both friends with Michael Brooks. And one of the things I loved about Michael is that he wouldn't just talk about what was happening in the U.S. He understood we have to look at Brazil. We have to look at U.S. foreign policy in other countries. We have to think internationally. And I think when we lost Michael, we lost one of the few voices who is making us think more globally. What do you think about sometimes there being a lack of international thinking on the left? Do you think we can ever overcome that?
Yeah, I think that the political situation in the United States is so crushing. The fact that it's kind of duopoly with no exit, you know, in sight. And the need of like incrementalism and, you know, fighting against all of the horrible things that are going on inside the United States causes a lot of people to just sacrifice international solidarity. And I see this really, I've been outside of the U.S. for over 20 years now, you know, but what I see really is like how the anti-war movement just pretty much disappeared. Like, nobody's really caring that the U.S., I mean, back in the, old days, like if the U.S. was in one war, there would be people on the streets every day fighting it. And the U.S. is in like 7 wars now. And it seems like a lot of people just given up So I don't know. I mean, I really miss Brooks. I wish he was around. I know he would have loved to see what's going on right now in the U.S. with Biden victory and all of that. And, you know, he would have been a really great guy to have around. I miss him, but he was important. And he really knew how to bring together people from different sides, you know, and mitigate different arguments on the left and find nuance in some of these, you know, policies and arguments and things like that. And I think that's missing in this climate now where everything has been like broken into this kind of like Homer Simpson level argument of tankies and Trotskyists or something, which doesn't even make sense really to me, you know, like I just miss him. I wish he was still around. And I really wish he could have seen this documentary because I was talking to him about it the week before he died. I told him I was going to interview Lula again. And we were talking about the questions I was going to ask in the interview and stuff. So it's just, you know, it's too bad. That's all I have to say about that. You know, I miss the guy.
I miss Michael a lot, too. And I think that we can all learn a lot from what he preached to us about international solidarity. I want to thank you, Brian Mayer, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
Well, Brazil Wire. I do correspondence for a news show on Telesur English called From the South. Those are the two best ways, I guess. I don't want to sound too depressing in this whole thing. I mean, I think there's some positivity going on right now. I think we're going to be able to get rid of Bolsonaro in the next year or two, hopefully.
You know, any reason for that? Why do you think so?
He's just becoming completely isolated. He lied to his fans that Trump was going to stay in power. And when Biden took over, he lost 11% of approval rating in 1 week.
So yeah, he thought the January 6th thing, Trump was going to stay in office, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like he was promoting it. So his support is nosediving right now.
Well, I guess that's a hopeful note to end on. Thanks again, Brian. I hope you'll come back on in the future.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brian Mayer, and consider checking out his new documentary available now, free of charge, on YouTube, Dismantling Brazil Bolsonaro's Neoliberal Agenda. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, It's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.